Hello, and welcome to Real Menopause Talk. My guest today is Diane Danzebrink. Diane is one of those guests who you could introduce in so many different ways, and it doesn't even begin to scratch the surface. She's a wife, a dog owner, she has professional nurse training in menopause, is a therapist, and yet she's probably best known for creating the Make Menopause Matter campaign. After her own incapacitating experience, Diane set up the campaign with three solid aims: to improve GP education, to raise awareness with employers and in the workplace, and to introduce menopause education into the curriculum. So from here, I will let Diane tell her story and educate us all. I present to you today the original menopause warrior. Diane, it is lovely to meet you. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Pleasure, Hattie. Thank you for inviting me.
For those who don't know you, would you mind introducing yourself and telling us a little bit about yourself and your background?
No, not at all. So I'm Diane Danzebrink. I'm probably known these days as the founder of menopausesupport.co.uk and the national Make Menopause Matter campaign. By profession, I'm a therapist and a wellbeing consultant. My special interests are obviously in menopause and in mental health. I have professional nurse training in menopause. And essentially, this all started nearly 10 years ago now with my own menopause experience. That's sort of how I come to be here. That's what kicked it all off.
And can you tell us whereabouts you are in terms of menopause and your menopause experience?
Yeah, sure. So now I am very much postmenopausal, and I actually have been postmenopausal for 9.5-ish years. So for me, I was 45 when I had to have surgery that put me directly into surgical menopause. So for those people not familiar with that, surgical menopause is where both of your ovaries are removed at the same time. Technically, that's known as a bilateral oophorectomy. So I had both of my ovaries and my womb and my cervix all removed, and that was because it was suspected that I had ovarian cancer. I had suffered probably for 15 plus years before that with excruciatingly painful periods, lots of abdominal and back pain, the sort of thing that sort of, I know lots of people will resonate with this, you know, you kind of curl yourself up in a ball and hope that it's going to go away. So periods, very painful, increasingly heavy, but I just thought, oh, well, I'm getting older, things are changing. I tried several times in the past to speak to medical health professionals about my excruciating abdominal pain. On one occasion, I was told that I was hysterical. And on another occasion, I was told that I wasn't in enough pain.
I'm sorry, enough pain?
I wasn't. Yeah, my husband called a GP to our home one night when I was really, you know, I was used to pain, but it really was over the top. And she told him that, well, it couldn't possibly be my appendix because I wasn't in enough pain. But if it got worse during the night, then I should call an ambulance. I'm not joking. I'm not making that up. On one occasion, I went to see a GP and he insisted that the best thing to do would be to do a scan of my kidneys. Completely the wrong side of the body. So you can imagine, I kind of gave up. Long story short is that when the pathology from the surgery came back, thankfully for me, the gynecologist was very sure that my surgery had been done in good time. But it did turn out that I had indeed been living with grade 4 endometriosis, which is the most severe, adenomyosis, which is a condition sort of opposite to endometriosis. So with endometriosis, some of the endometrial tissue migrates outside of the womb and sticks itself mainly into the pelvis, but for some people it can travel to other areas in the body. But adenomyosis is where the endometrium grows through into the muscle that surrounds the womb. And that's what was causing all the lower back pain that I could never get a handle on. And to top it all off, I had a massive fibroid as well. So the surgery for me was definitely the right thing to do. However, unfortunately, I did not get adequate professional medical advice and information prior to my surgery about being put into surgical menopause. So my knowledge of menopause was hot flashes and night sweats and no more periods. I knew I wouldn't have periods anymore. And before I left the hospital, which was 48 hours after my surgery, the only thing I was told was, put your feet up for a few weeks and then go and see your doctor, see how you're doing. That was it. Sum total of my menopause information. So I, like everybody else, I'd heard all the scary stuff about HRT. And I also, way back in the kind of dim and distant past, I had heard that some of it was made from pregnant mare's urine, which just horrified. I was a horse owner at the time, just absolutely horrified me. So that combined with the scary stories, I was sort of, well, no, it's all right, thanks. That's not even something I will contemplate. I will take myself off to a nutritionist. I will do everything I can to be healthy once I feel fit again. And left the nutritionist with 7 different pots of supplements. Not great for somebody that doesn't like swallowing pills, but was assured that this would see me through my surgical menopause. I wouldn't need anything else. In hindsight, I know that to be absolute nonsense, but unfortunately, I didn't know it at the time. And consequently, so for the first 3 months or so after surgery, I felt okay. And about, I would say, probably towards the end of month 3, beginning of month 4, things started to change quite dramatically. My mental health took a real nosedive. I became increasingly anxious. My sleep pattern fell apart. I would wake up in a panic. I became increasingly agoraphobic. This was over a period of weeks. Didn't want to leave the house. Didn't want to walk my dogs anymore, which was sort of my favorite thing to do every morning. Stopped wanting to have people at the house. So stopped wanting to have any sort of visitors. Was really, really reluctant to answer the phone, to the point eventually where I wouldn't answer the phone at all because I'd completely lost any confidence. And my outlook on life had become incredibly dark and negative. I felt like a useless, hopeless, worthless husk of the person that I used to be, and was terrified. I just basically completely irrational in my thinking now that I look back at it, to the point where I wouldn't even open post that came through the door because I had convinced myself that everything was going to be bad news. I was plaguing my poor husband because I was convinced that the future was very bleak for us. And eventually it got to the point where I came incredibly close to taking my own life. And the only thing that stopped me was at a very crucial moment, one of my little dogs barked and stopped me from doing what I was going to do. That prompted a real crisis situation where my husband, who had been trying to persuade me to see a doctor for weeks and weeks, and I wouldn't because I was terrified that I would be admitted to a mental health unit because I felt like I was going mad. He basically took over, and rather than asking me to see a doctor, he actually went to our GP practice the same day and said, I really need to see somebody today. And they were very good. And I saw a doctor that evening. And that was about 8 months after my surgery. And she was the first medical health professional ever to explain the complexities of surgical menopause, how the rapid loss of estrogen can have significant effects, not just on physical health, but on mental health too. And how at 45, it was absolutely vital that I should replace my hormone. She explained to me that it was no longer all pregnant mare's urine. Actually, the vast majority of estrogen was plant derived and body identical. She explained that I didn't have to have a tablet, that I could have a patch to stick on my skin. And consequently, I stuck that patch on the same day. And I'm always a bit nervous of saying how quickly I started to see an improvement, because I don't want people to think that HRT is magic and it happens overnight, because A, it's not, and B, it doesn't. But because I was in such a low place, anything was an improvement. And I would say within a few days, the sort of dark world that I was living in, I could sort of see the faintest chink of light that made me feel that there was some hope for the future. And then fast forward on a few weeks, my relief just turned to anger at what I'd almost done, simply because of a lack of information at the right time. So I started to do what we all do when we're looking for information, and I turned to social media and the internet, started to Google to see if other people had felt like I felt, were feeling like I was feeling, and I was horrified, absolutely horrified, to find thousands of people saying things like, please help me, I think I'm going mad, I don't know who I am anymore, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember turning to my husband and saying, how the hell can this be right? We're half the population. How is it that half the population enter a stage of their lives that they know absolutely nothing about, and there is not adequate support for? If I ever feel like me again, I'm going to make damn sure I do something to change it. And here we are.
Diane, that is an amazing story. And I know everything that you're doing is phenomenal. The changes you're making in Parliament and to women's lives directly and indirectly. Your story is still happening to people, though. I've spoken to a large number of women who have had hysterectomies of various types, and are not prepared, not just underprepared, but not prepared at all for the possibility that they might feel different after surgery. Their surgeons go up to them as they're coming out of anaesthetic just to report back. So, I mean, having been under general anaesthetic for other things, I know I'm not in my right mind at that moment in time, never mind to hear anything of any significance. But this is still happening. So many of us are underprepared anyway, but to go into surgery, how is this still the case?
Well, there's a couple of things. Firstly, there's a lack of joined up thinking within the NHS system. So I don't blame my GP at all, because my GP, as we know, many GPs have had no menopause education. I was very lucky at crisis point to see a GP who did have some menopause education and recognize what was going on for me. However, the process is usually an individual will present to their GP, and the GP will recognize that there is something that needs specialist care. So they're then referred into the hospital system, at which point they probably have scans and tests. And particularly if we're talking specifically for gynecological, they're going to see a gynecologist. So that gynecologist is probably going to be interested in treatment, or as you say, for any kind of hysterectomy, oophorectomy, etc., surgery. So is that gynecologist menopause aware? Have they had menopause education? Probably not. Just because they're a gynecologist doesn't mean, I know people can't see your face, but I can see your face and your eyes have just widened. Do gynecologists all have thorough menopause education? No, they don't, not unless they specialize. So essentially, you are handed over to somebody who understands the job they need to do, but they might not be up to date with how important hormone replacement therapy is, or for somebody who can't have it, what other options there might be for you, They probably are not familiar with, you know, sort of the differences between a natural and a surgical menopause, sort of how significant the differences, the changes can be after a surgical menopause. They're probably not up to date to counsel you. So what happens is the gynecologist does their job, which is they diagnose you, they tell you what they're going to do, management or surgery wise, they do their surgery to the best of their ability. They, as you say, come round and see you when you're dozy and drowsy and you can't take a word in that they're saying, and tell you about the surgery. And then in my case, you never see them again. So I never was offered a follow-up with the gynecology. Now, how can that possibly be that women are going for radical surgery, which is going to have a significant effect on their lives, and they don't go back and see somebody? You think about all of the medical procedures that go on in hospital and all of the follow-ups that go on. So how come we don't get it for this?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make sense. But you're absolutely right. So what happens is the gynecologist then writes a letter which goes to your GP practice, and then it's up to, I don't know, a doctor at your GP practice to pick that up and look at it and say, okay, this person's in surgical menopause, what do we need to do about that? Well, is the doctor, is the GP going to be adequately trained to manage surgical menopause? Probably not. Are they going to be adequately trained to manage induced menopause? So for somebody who has had chemotherapy, for somebody who has had their ovarian function suppressed, for endometriosis or PMDD, no, because it should be in specialist care. But the specialists are basically putting it back to the GPs to deal with, who some of them have not had any menopause education whatsoever. So basically the patients are caught in the middle of a system that doesn't work.
And depending on where you live as well, the GP won't contact you. It's up to you to contact the GP. But if you're unaware of all of this to begin with, then the chances of you going back to them are slim. And knowing at which point, thank goodness for your husband, to do that, it is very difficult. How are you doing now?
Oh, really well.
Great.
but having said really well, as I said, you know, sort of I'm always really reticent about when I talk about how quickly or well HRT worked, because there is no doubt about it. There is no doubt that were it not for HRT, I wouldn't be here, because it did make that much of a difference to me. It replaced the hormones that had been taken away. And as we know, for anybody who is in a similar position to me, you know, might even be younger, the general advice, the national advice is, if you can replace hormones, if your medical history will allow you to do that, they should be replaced at least until the natural age of menopause, which is around 51, 52. So it wasn't an overnight success. I had that initial movement from that very dark place that I was living in to feeling more hopeful. But it was a process. And it took around 2 years for me to really feel back to me. And unfortunately, during that time, my medical situation, my history, if you like, meant that what I needed was outside of my GP's knowledge base. So I did ask for a referral into an NHS menopause clinic, which took months and months, and actually was quite disappointing when I got there. So I did end up having to pay privately. I had to put it on a credit card, but I did end up having to pay privately for an appointment. And it was, as many people have said, you know, I don't regret a penny of it, but ultimately I shouldn't have had to do it. And nor should anybody that's having to do it today. And far too many people are having to do that. And we also have to remember that millions and millions and millions of the population could never even consider it for a moment. So it took about 2 years to get the dose right, to get the regime right, and for me to feel steady And when I say back to myself, I don't think you're ever really back to yourself. I think it's just you're moving on. It's, you know, sort of it's a new version of you. But there are positives to that as well. You know, sort of it's not all negative. There are, once you get through that sort of that tricky time, there are positives to it as well.
How is your husband?
He's good. bless him. He had a bit of a baptism of fire on Friday because, I mean, he's been massively supportive throughout this. I mean, it's interesting when we talk about it because I think I put him through a really difficult time. I can't imagine what it must be to support somebody who has fundamentally changed so much so quickly. He was very level-headed about it all. And when I talk to him about it now, he says, well, you know, there would have been no point panicking. I knew that you needed me to be supportive. And this is throughout the whole, you know, the whole period. So, you know, that was what I was there to do. At the worst times, he did have to ask my mum to come and stay with us because he was so worried about my mental health. That was before, you know, before I got to see the doctor. But he has been hugely supportive, not just of me managing those symptoms, but also of what I've chosen to do over the last few years with all the campaigning, etc. But the poor man's eyes nearly fell out when I read an email to him a couple of weeks ago, which said from Loose Women, who were going to interview me, and then said, actually, we'd like a man's view as well. Will he come on? And to be fair, TV could not be further outside Martin's comfort zone if we tried. I don't think there's anything worse we could ask him to do. But bless his heart, he said, if it helps to raise awareness and it helps one person, then yes, of course, I'll come and do it. So I have kind of put him through it. To be fair, but he's still here and he's still very supportive every day. So that's great. But he's also learnt a huge amount and has had some very interesting conversations himself. I mean, he's retired now, but in his professional life, he was an equine dental technician. So he looked after horses' teeth. Most people who own horses are women. And a lot of them knew me, knew what had happened to me. So he spent the sort of the latter years of his professional career, not just doing horses' teeth, but also dispensing menopause information.
That's amazing. Bless him for doing that.
I'm very proud of.
Absolutely. Oh, good for him. See, we need more of that. How did menopausesupport.co.uk come about?
In the couple of years when I was really kind of, I suppose, getting myself back together, I had a lot of time to research and a lot of time to think about what I wanted to do going forward. So I did a lot of research, I did a lot of education, a lot of reading. I did some professional nurse training in menopause to sort of combine with my therapy work, and decided that I would like to start to counsel women individually. So initially, that's what I started to do. This is sort of back in 2015. And at the same time, I thought it would be nice to have some kind of resource where we could share free information for people. So I know nothing. I mean, I know nothing about tech whatsoever. So a friend of mine helped to set up a website called Menopause Support. And for a couple of years, it was just an information space. But more recently, about 2 years ago, I sort of relaunched it, if you like, as a community interest company. So a community interest company, for people who aren't familiar, is basically, it's a business, it's a limited company, but rather than being run for profit, it's run so that any profits that it makes go back into the business. So creating things like resources, etc. We use some of ours to provide more affordable one-to-one consultations for people. We also provide training for businesses and organizations, awareness, and obviously we run the campaign. So as far as the one-to-ones are concerned, they're not counselling sessions. They're one-to-ones for, they're one-offs. And most of the people that access them are people who say, I couldn't possibly afford a consultation with a private menopause specialist because you're running into hundreds of pounds. But I can't get the help that I need from my GP. So essentially what we do is we sort of listen to their experience, talk them through all the available options, ask them what they'd like to try, and then 9 times out of 10, write a supporting letter for the GP. Also helping, trying to help the GP to point them to resources that could help them going forward as well. So that's how menopause support sort of started. We're a tiny team. There's only 3 of us in the office, if you like. There's myself, my fabulous friend and colleague, who is also my office manager, Andrea, and my consultancy colleague, Steph's an ex-nurse who also has professional nurse training. So we do the consultations between us. And then we have a fabulous team of 4 volunteers who look after our private menopause community. So we have a community on Facebook called the Menopause Support Network. I think we're supporting just under 28,000 women there at the moment. So that's fully moderated Monday to Friday, as and when the team have time at the weekends. But yeah, so that's what we do, basically. That's what menopause support does. And then obviously the campaign came about a bit later. So it was back in 2018. It was pure frustration. I'd sat at my desk one evening and I'd had yet another heartbreaking email from somebody. And I just thought, that's enough. We need a campaign. We need a national menopause campaign. So I had a quick look to see where I could launch it. Already knew from all the hundreds and thousands of people that we'd spoken to and supported that the key issues for them were GP education, lack of support in the workplace, and there was this just general lack of education for the public. So I created the 3 aims, which are mandatory training for all GPs and medical students, to have better menopause guidance and support in every workplace, and to have menopause taught in secondary schools. I launched it in Parliament in October 2018, and by July 2019, we'd heard from the Education Secretary that he had approved adding menopause to the curriculum in England from September 2020. So, you know, one tick, but obviously we want that to be throughout the rest of the UK. I think we've got about 170,000 signatures on the petition now, which is great, but obviously we always want some more. And I think the thing in the workplace is sort of happening organically because there's been so much noise made about menopause in the last couple of years. I think employers are starting to realise that it's a sensible way forward. It's the right thing to do. I think the biggest nut to crack is going to be GP education. That's the one that's going to take the longest. But fundamentally, it's the one that is the barrier to most people, because if the gatekeeper of good health says no, for many people, they don't have anywhere else to go.
And that is essentially letting people down, because it is... Yes, everybody. We're all affected by it. That's the thing that I think is beginning to creep out. So half the population have lived experience of this, and we all know somebody. So that person who we know will also be indirectly affected. So it is literally a global issue that needs to be taken care of. I feel you're right. Workplaces are beginning to address what needs to be done. I also feel that in our menopause world that we're creating, is wonderful, yes, all sorts of things are happening. And there are days where I think, why am I doing this? Everybody knows everything already. It's great. And then you take one tiny step out and there's a lot to be done. What else can we do, and what next for the Make Menopause Matter campaign?
So what else can we do? So I think the first thing I would say is talk about it. You're so right when you say, oh my goodness, nobody's going to want to hear me say this again, because it's already out there. But what we forget is that people are becoming perimenopausal every day. We also forget that there's an awful lot of people who don't have access to the internet and social media. So we have to think about how those people get access to the right information. So I think the first thing is if you're listening to this today and you've heard something that you think, oh, I think I should pass that on, don't think about it, pass it on. So, you know, whether it is passing on something that Hattie or I have said, whether it is passing on the menopause support website so that people can access some free resources, whether it's just having a chat with your friends, your colleagues, your partner. You know, for so many people, they find it so difficult to talk to their partner about what they're experiencing because they don't understand it themselves. So I think mm-hmm. the first thing is talking. I think the second thing is getting active. So if you are somebody who has struggled at your GP practice, I think there are really simple things you can do. You can have a chat with the practice. It's usually with the practice manager. Ask if you can be part of the patient participation group at the practice. They all have them, so that you can raise menopause as an educational issue within the practice that needs to be addressed. If you've had any kind of difficulty accessing treatment or hormone replacement therapy, if that's been your choice, if you're experiencing the current shortages, get in touch with your MP. I know that many of us feel that it's a waste of time getting in touch with our MP. But if we all take the attitude that it's a waste of time, then none of us will ever do it. So it's really important. And I would say that I have, rather than writing to the MP, I've requested to speak to or see my MP. And actually, where I live, I've done that a couple of times in the last year. So they all have surgeries. A lot of them are online. But rather than writing to them, because they can just send you back a standard reply, actually ask to have a conversation with them and say to them, why isn't menopause care better? What are you going to do about it? Who are you going to take this to at Westminster? So I think it's, you know, sort of taking action locally with your practice, but also locally with your MP. I've been encouraging everybody over the last few days because of the HRT shortages that people are experiencing to share their experience directly with the Department of Health. The contact details for the Department of Health are hidden away on their website, right at the bottom of the page. But there is a telephone number. There is also a form that you can complete to email them. If you've been struggling, you know, do something, take some action. Mm-hmm. Because whilst I'm sure people are sick and tired of hearing me banging on, it's not going to stop anytime soon, but I'm sure people are sick and tired of it. But the thing is, if we all do something in our local area, that sort of that trickle becomes so much bigger. And eventually people will start to take notice. Really simple things that you can do too. So if you're somebody who feels confident to speak about your experience, your local press will be delighted. Your local radio and your local newspaper are always looking for content to fill out their minute, their airwave minutes or their printed pages. So if you're willing to talk to them about your experience and you want to call for something to be different, get in touch with your local press. Sign and share the Make Menopause Matter campaign petition, which you can find on the Menopause Support website, which is menopausesupport.co.uk, because you'll be adding your voice. You know, sort of, I'm always talking to people about raise your voice. Now, some people feel they can, other people don't want to do that. But just signing the petition, that's adding your voice to all of those others who are recognizing that what we're talking about is a significant problem and really does need to be addressed. I think it's also important that we recognise that campaigning, making change is a marathon, not a sprint. Mm-hmm. You know, when I first spoke about starting the campaign, somebody much wiser than me who had been involved in campaigning for many years said, you do realise you're talking about 10 years of your life, don't you, at least, to see any change. So having education included on the curriculum after 9 months was amazing. But they're right. It is, you know, kind of things do move slowly. The process moves slowly. As by the time you listen to this, as many of you will be aware, we had the big announcement in October from Maria Caulfield, the minister at the Department of Health, that there was going to be a single annual fee for HRT, for a year's worth of HRT. And all the newspapers and the TV stations got very excited, and she did lots of interviews about it, etc. And then it all went very quiet. And we were bombarded with messages, as were lots of other people, about, okay, so when's it going to start? When's it going to happen? And I kept saying, I will let you know as soon as I know something. And it was announced yesterday that it's not going to happen until April 2023. So a good 18 months after. So it's typical. You know, you get all the headline grabbing news, but actually there's no substance behind it. There's no detail behind it. This hasn't been thought about for when it's going to be implemented. And then that just leaves already anxious people who are worrying about getting their HRT or worrying about getting to see somebody about their menopause symptoms and what their options might be. It just leaves them feeling more stressed and anxious. So I know a lot of people are massively disappointed. I'm disappointed, but not surprised. But say something, write to Maria Caulfield, tell her just how difficult it is. There's a video going around on Twitter in which she said yesterday in the House that essentially people could already have 12 months of HRT. Because NICE guidance says that once you're settled on HRT, that you can have 12 months. Well, I don't know what planet she's living on, but people that I speak to struggle to get 3 months at a time. Mm-hmm. Yep. A lot of people are having to pay monthly. So that's just not lived reality. And if that's not your lived reality, please send a message and tell these people that this information that they're giving is not what's going on the ground. We keep seeing inquiries, task forces, groups gathering together. And great, look at the problems, but what we need is we need some action, because people are getting very tired of keep hearing, you know, we hear you, we're listening. Well, don't just listen, do something.
What next specifically for the campaign?
Well, as far as the campaign is concerned, we've just been in contact with the education departments in Wales and Scotland. And I'm pleased to say that it looks as though things are moving in the right direction for menopause on the curriculum there. Still waiting to hear back from Northern Ireland. So who knows? We'll see. But then as far as the campaign is concerned, as I said, I think organically, things are starting to change in the workplace. So I think that's something that's going to continue to grow. I think our focus is going to be on what resources are being provided to teachers and schools to be able to teach menopause appropriately, because it's fine to get it on the curriculum, but actually we need to be giving the people tasks to teach it the right sort of resources to be able to do that. And then, of course, we will be focusing again on what is going to change as far as GP education is concerned. So I think we're sort of working on the basis that the workplace is improving, and that needs keeping an eye on. But I think for us, resources for education and how things are fundamentally going to happen for GP and medical school education are going to be the way forward.
It all comes down to education right from the very roots, and off we go, hopefully. 100%. Yeah. Have you got any positive stories that have been told to you?
Lots, lovely. Before coming on here today, I was doing an awareness session for an organisation, and that was one of the questions at the end, is there anything positive? I think rather than pick an individual case study, I think it's probably better for me to talk about sort of collective experience of those who become postmenopausal and recognize the benefits, if you like. From a practical point of view, for some people, they feel that the ending of periods is, you know, sort of is wonderful because actually they've had a really tricky time with them throughout their lives and it's just not something that they want to cope with anymore. Other people take a different view around periods. So I don't think we can say it's a one size fits all. It's very individual. But I think the word that we rarely hear associated with menopause is opportunity. And I think for many people, once you do have the right help and the right support, and you do feel, you know, sort of you do feel yourself, whatever that new self is, it does present an opportunity to look at what your previous experiences have been, what wisdom you've taken from them, how you're going to use that going forward, but also to look at how you're looking after yourself. How are you prioritizing yourself as an individual? Have you spent your entire life prioritizing other people? And that's not to say that other people don't still feature in your list of priorities, but perhaps you move yourself up that list of priorities a little more, looking at practical things like, how am I nourishing myself? Have I got into the habit of drinking too much alcohol? Am I eating too much sugar? Am I taking too much caffeine? Can I perhaps change the way I exercise? Is the way I exercise now going to be different from the way that I've exercised in the past? What can I do to look after my well-being as far as my sort of my mental health is concerned? So do I need to be taking a bit more time for myself, a bit more downtime, doing things that you enjoy? And then also from a sort of wider perspective, If I look at where I am now, bearing in mind that for the vast majority, they're going to live 30 years plus postmenopausally, do I have professional or personal ambitions that I haven't met yet? And how might I go about meeting them? But also, I think for a lot of people, they come to this time, this because menopause is a transition. And I don't just think it's a physical transition. I think it's for many people, it's a spiritual transition too. It's a transition of transition and transformation. It is a change. So I think for a lot of people, they start to recognize that perhaps there is a little spring clean needed of things that don't serve them anymore. That could potentially include people that are not, they're not good for them anymore. But it's often about things that don't serve them well anymore or practices that don't serve them well anymore. So I think it's also a really good opportunity for looking at, okay, so if that doesn't serve me well, what will serve me better? And for many people, as part of that, they develop new purpose and new passion. And that can put a real spring in the postmenopausal step. And I think that's vital to put yourself as enough of a priority to take that time to reflect and then to look to the future.
I couldn't agree more. And I love that opportunity. Is there anything you would like to add?
I think probably the most important thing is if you're currently at the perimenopausal or postmenopausal stage and you don't feel that you have had the right advice and support, don't think that that's it. There are lots of fabulous resources out there. Women's Health Concern is a great resource. It's the patient arm of the British Menopause Society. NICE guidance is well worth you having a look at. We've priced down a lot of the information in NICE guidance onto sort of more bite-sized documents on the website. But if you're somebody who either you're going to be approaching perimenopause at some point in the future, or you're somebody who might be supporting perimenopause during the future, then educate yourself. Learn as much as you can about it before you come along to allow you to make informed decisions for yourself or for you to be able to better support those people that you know and love.
Wonderful. Thank you very much indeed, Diane. Thank you so much for your time. You too. Take care.
Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. You can find Diane at menopausesupport.co.uk. The website has a wealth of information. You can join the community and please sign and share the petition, which you can also find on the website. We can all raise awareness of menopause. And finally, follow us on the podcast apps and leave a review. Tell everybody you know all about Real Menopause Talk, the podcast, and get them to download and listen to it. It will help us keep the podcast going. And ultimately, the more we spread the word, the more we can see meaningful change. Thank you for listening. I look forward to seeing you in the next episode.